This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil, now streaming, only on Hulu.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, I am Nicholas Gordon, host of the Asian Review of Books podcast, done in partnership with the New Books Network. In this podcast, we interview fiction and nonfiction authors working in, around, and about the Asia-Pacific region. There's a popular folk hero in Puebla, Mexico, Catarina de San Juan, who Mexicans hailed as a devout religious figure after her death in 1688. She's credited with creating the China Poblana dress, a connection of dubious historical veracity made several centuries after her death. But Catarina is one of Mexico's most famous chinos, despite the fact that she was likely from India, not China. In fact, any Asian that disembarked in Mexico, whether from China, Japan, the Philippines, India, or even further away, was called chino. It was not a particularly beneficial classification. Chinos, under Spanish law, could be enslaved. Indios, Asian populations, could not. That's just one part of Diego Luis' historical investigation of the first Asians in the Americas in a book titled, appropriately, The First Asians in the Americas, A Trans-Pacific History. Diego is a professor in history at Tufts University. Today, Diego and I talk about Asians in the Spanish Empire, both in the Philippines and in Mexico, and some of the interesting ways that these first Asians tried to push back against their oppressors. So, Diego, thanks for coming on the show to talk about your book, you know, The First Asians in the Americas, A Trans-Pacific History. You know, perhaps it's best to start with your book's title. Who exactly were the first, quote unquote, Asians in the Americas? And I from reading your book, I know qualifying that term Asians is important, but who exactly were these people?
Yeah, so thanks for having me on the show, Nicholas. The first Asians in the Americas, the title of the book, were people who were both free and enslaved, who ended up traveling across the Pacific Ocean on Spanish ships from 1565 to 1815. These were the years that these Spanish ships across the Pacific between the colonies and the Philippines and those of the Americas by way of Mexico. And it was on these ships that you have this enormously diverse population of people arriving in the Americas. And these were people that came from everywhere, from as far west as Gujarat in India, down through southern India, the Malabar coast, for example, up through Southeast Asia, including the what were called the Spice Islands of Indonesia. These were Ternate and Tidore, up through the Philippines, southern China, and southern Japan as well. This is an enormously diverse population that crosses the Pacific at this time. And these are precisely the people who are the subject of the history that I've written.
And one interesting thing you note is that all the Asians in I guess New Spain, they were all called chinos, whether they were from India, China, Japan, Indonesia, or further afield.
Yeah, so that's one of the things that really fascinated me about doing the research for the book was this term chino, Because when you're looking at archives in colonial Mexico, you're looking at archives in Spain about Mexico, again, which is where a lot of these people ended up. You see this term a lot, Chino, China. And there's this question, who were these people that are categorized with this word? Colonial Mexican society had words that lumped lots of different kinds of people into categories and then ascribed laws to them. So you have words to describe Africans and Afro-descendants like negros and mulatos that become part of what's called the caste system or the sistema de castas, which again is a discourse that uses these categories, these words, in order to ascribe laws to those groups. And so when Asians come to the Americas, again, coming from this wide range of locations, oftentimes they're called Chinos after arrival. And so Chino, you know, it literally means Chinese in Spanish, means that in modern Spanish, meant that in Spanish at the time too. And so this word Chinese comes to describe all of these people, regardless of origin. It's the first time in the history of the Americas that you have a single word that can now refer to all people who are perceived as having originated from somewhere in Asia, specifically coastal Asia. And what that term does, it emerges in the 1590s, sort of becomes more common around the turn of the 17th century and becomes really decisively implemented as the predominant label to refer to Asians by 1615 in the port where they're arriving, which is the port of Acapulco in Mexico. And it's a strange thing to happen. On the one hand, because all of these people are being called Chinese. And one of the reasons that that happens is because one of the terms used to refer to Asia at this time for people in colonial Mexico was La China. So China was a stand-in in some ways for the totality of Asia. And it's that kind of selective geography that then becomes the sweeping term that can refer to all Asians. It's a strange thing to happen because a lot of the people who are called Chinos when they arrive in Mexico, they're called other terms when they board Spanish ships in the Philippines. It's only when they disembark that they all become Chinos. For example, when they board the ships in the Philippines, at the port of Cavite, which is just to the south of Manila, which was the capital of the Spanish colony in the Philippines. When they board those ships, Chino was a term that could refer only to Chinese people. So it's very odd that you have this kind of transformation in terms that becomes decisive upon arrival in the Americas. And what this does is, it makes people who are called Chinos vulnerable, legally vulnerable to being enslaved. And this is because many of the people who boarded those ships, they're called another term. Many of them are called Indios in the Philippines. Indio could refer to any person deemed to be an indigenous subject of lands claimed by the Spanish Empire. Indios were supposed to be legally free from enslavement, even if in practice that was oftentimes not the case. Now, when many people, indigenous Filipinos, for example, who are called Indios in the Philippines, become Chinos in Spain, in Mexico, then they can legally be enslaved. Or if they're already enslaved, it legally reinforces their enslavability. They can also be persecuted by the Inquisition now. As Chinos, they're banned from participating in certain trades. They're banned from carrying weapons at various times. And so there's all these laws that are now ascribed to the people who are called Chinos after arrival.
I mean, before we get into more of the history of this journey, I mean, maybe you can explain, you know, why was it that if you were Indios, you were supposed to be, at least, I guess, safe from being enslaved? Or was it about being indigenous to New Spain that kind of protected you in that way?
Yeah, so the term Indio was a global category. I think oftentimes, you know, in the Americas, we think of indigeneity as meaning a very specific thing. And, you know, specifically referring to indigenous inhabitants of the Americas. The concept of indigeneity as it existed in the early modern world within the Spanish Empire was a global one. You know, Spain claimed the lands and oceans of everywhere between basically what's now modern day Brazil all the way to Southeast Asia. And all of the inhabitants of those lands were called Indios. And of course, this is the term that Columbus infamously uses in the Caribbean to describe the people that that he encounters there because of this enormous geographical confusion in which he believes he's actually arrived in Asia when in fact he's very far from Asia. But he thinks that the people that he sees are Indians, literally Indians. And this is why he calls them Indios. And so that term sticks. But it's one that can refer to any indigenous vassal subject of lands claimed by the Spanish Empire everywhere from the Americas to Asia. So when you have missionaries like the Dominican missionary Bartolomé de las Casas, who writes in support of these indigenous vassal subjects, and most significantly, to support measures like the new laws of 1542, which banned the enslavement, at least formally, again, even if in practice, the reality is quite different, but at least formally banned the enslavement of indigenous subjects, those laws would eventually apply to the Asian context as well. So you have this global concept of who Indios were that's now being revised once many of these people who are considered Indios are now arriving in the Americas.
So let's kind of go to the I guess the origin point of this journey, which is the Philippines and Manila. You do talk about the Philippines and Manila, I think, quite a bit in your book. It's probably roughly like the first third. Why is it important to talk about how the Spanish authorities worked with and I guess ruled over Asians in the Philippines, whether Filipino or Chinese or other kind of, I guess, migrants to Manila?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, one of the very important arguments that the book makes is that, you know, the nature of colonialism in the Philippines is what generates this trans-Pacific movement in Asian peoples who are both free and enslaved. You know, I believe we have to look at the sites where people are coming from in order to understand what their experiences are in the Americas. And, you know, one of the really important things here is that they're departing from Manila and the port of Cavite. These are Spanish colonies. These are people who have experience with the nature of Spanish colonialism by the time that they arrive in the Americas. You know, many of them have been baptized, have some familiarity of Catholicism. They're given Hispanic names, and at least in, you know, legal records, they lose the names that they had before they're baptized. And many of them learn to speak Spanish, or at least a kind of broken Spanish, in Manila as well. And so all of that kind of informs their experiences of the Spanish colonial world by the time they arrive in Mexico. But you know, like you mentioned, the Philippines, the history of the Philippines is one that I find absolutely fascinating. And I wanted it to be a prominent part of the book because Colonial Manila is really an exceptional site within the Spanish Empire, in part because of what you mentioned, because of the social demographics of the colony. You know, this is a place where Spaniards are an extreme minority within Manila. You know, oftentimes they're outnumbered as much as 20 or 30 to 1 by Chinese inhabitants of the colony, not to mention indigenous people of the Philippines, South Asians, other Southeast Asians, Japanese, who often also inhabit Manila at numbers that rival the Spanish or exceed the Spanish population. And one of the really important things that happens in Manila in the late 16th century and the early 17th century is precisely this growth of the Chinese population there that arrive in Manila to trade with Spaniards for silver that's being brought across the Pacific from the Americas, where it's being mined in extremely large quantities. And they're trading that silver oftentimes for Chinese goods like porcelain, like silks, lacquer, and so forth, or simply for foodstuffs to sustain the colony. And so that generates this increasingly large population in Manila of people who are not Catholic, are not Hispanicized, and they become this kind of existential threat in the Spanish mindset to their presence in the Philippines. And so much of that first third of the book is looking at the conflicts between these communities, in part because many of the people who end up in showing up in records, colonial records in the Americas, most of them are not of Chinese origin, which to me is a very strange thing. If they sort of had this such a prominent role in the Spanish Philippines, we would expect them to show up in larger numbers in the Americas. And the fact that that doesn't happen kind of pointed me to what was happening in the Philippines at the same time. And so one of those flashpoints in the history of this conflict between the Spanish and the Chinese community was an uprising, a Chinese uprising in 1603, which in many ways is provoked by the last couple of decades of anti-Chinese sentiment on the part of Spaniards in the colony, and a series of laws and abuses that are exacted upon the Chinese population. And so there's this uprising in 1603 that becomes a flashpoint for Asians who would come to cross the Pacific in that history, because fighting against the Chinese in collaboration with the Spaniards becomes an avenue for social mobility for indigenous people of the Philippines, for Japanese people living in Manila as well. And it also increases the dependency of Spaniards on these other communities too, because this population of 20,000 or 30,000 Chinese in Manila, during this uprising, this war really to suppress this uprising, that population gets completely destroyed. Whether it's because they're driven from the Philippines or because they're just outright massacred by the Spanish and coalition army that fights against them, that itself places the Spanish colonists in a relationship that heightens their dependency upon, in particular, indigenous people of the Philippines. And so that begins to change the social fabric of colonial Manila, and it in fact intensifies the slave trade that was active in East Asia, Southeast Asia, South Asia, and East Africa, and captives from those places and sort of encourages or motivates Spaniards to buy those captives in larger numbers than they had before. And a portion of that slave trade, in fact, extends across the Pacific. And that's where you get, you know, thousands of enslaved Asians ending up in colonial Mexico. So for me, the history of the Philippines is extremely important in telling that story.
So obviously they have to get the Asians that eventually end up in Mexico and elsewhere, obviously have to cross the Pacific. A journey that I assume was very difficult and very taxing, just given the technology at the time and the length of the journey. But I guess from your research, I mean, what have you like uncovered about what these trips were actually like? I know you note that many certainly did not willingly go on these ships. Many were kind of press ganged and basically put into slavery. But what were these maritime journeys like?
Yeah, that's a great question, and that's one of the things that also really compelled me about the history of this movement was just how extreme that journey was. I mean, today we think about the trip between the Americas and Asia on a plane as being particularly arduous because it lasts, you know, maybe 12 or 16 hours, depending on where you're going. But the Trans-Pacific journey in the early modern world lasted over 6 months, oftentimes, to get from the port of Cavite in the Philippines to the destination, the port of Acapulco in Mexico. And after, upon departing the Philippines, there was no opportunity to stop and take on supplies until arriving in northern Mexico. And that's an unimaginable journey, I think, from the 21st century perspective. These ships were very interesting in their time. They were primarily trade ships, these galleons that made the journey. And because they were trade ships that were bringing, you know, these highly coveted Chinese products, for example, or South Asian textiles or Philippine textiles and ceramics to the Americas, because those goods were so sought after by colonial elites in places like Mexico City and Lima and elsewhere, the hulls of the ships were filled with those goods. Meaning that most of the people on the ships did not have any quarters below decks to sleep in. Especially the most marginalized people on those ships, who were invariably either Asian sailors or enslaved Asians or enslaved Africans in some cases. Most of them had to sleep on the deck of the ship. In some areas of the ships, there's a covered section under what was called the forecastle or the aftercastle, but that was still exposed to the open air. And if you didn't have a space sort of beneath the forecastle or the aftercastle, you were simply exposed to the elements. And these ships, in order to make the crossing, they had to rise to a very high latitude by Japan in order to be able to cross the Pacific because of the currents, because of weather patterns. And so oftentimes when these ships were making the crossing, they were exposed to storms, they were exposed to bitter cold. And that resulted in hundreds and even thousands of casualties over the course of the shipping line, which again lasted from 1565 to 1815. It's 250 years that these ships were crossing the Pacific. And so the journey was extreme, to say the least. And it was impossible to take on supplies that would last the entire journey, either enough fresh water in the ship or food. And so when rations were cut, which they almost always were by the end of the journey, it was these sailors, these Asian sailors and enslaved Asians who oftentimes suffered the brunt of that. So this journey was transformational in many ways. It really thrust everyone together onto this kind of mobile world for 6 months or longer, in which religious ritual was prominent, and people are speaking a wide variety of languages, and this is, I argue in the book, where you start to get a conception of Asian people that collapses their difference on these ships, because so many people are thrust into the same laboring roles on the ships that minimizes the differences between them in Spanish eyes and contributes to the creation of this Chino label that encapsulates everybody upon arrival in Mexico.
So were there any differences in how Asians were treated within kind of Spain's, I guess, American colonies? Because obviously they when Asians arrive, they do get put in this very kind of racialized system. But were there any differences between, say, Mexico and Peru, in terms of how they treat Asians, and even between, say, New Spain and Spain proper? Did different parts of the Spanish Empire treat Asians differently?
Yeah, I mean, that's a complicated question, and that's one that's that was really a driving force for my own research in this book too. One of the things that that really interested me about trying to uncover the nature of these experiences upon arrival in Mexico is how individuals try to differentiate themselves from this mass. And oftentimes, the way that I track that is through license petitions. And these are licenses to carry weapons, to ride horseback, licenses to sell various goods or practice certain trades. And this is because there were sort of totalizing bans on the kinds of people who could do these activities. And so you have people like Francisco de Lima, for example, who's a South Asian merchant in Mexico, who petitions to be able to carry weapons while he's traveling around central Mexico selling his goods. And he's just one example. I mean, there's dozens of cases that that I use in order to have a kind of broader look at the problems and possibilities of social mobility for Asian subjects. To what extent could they argue for special exemptions and privileges that were categorically denied? And a lot of the successful cases come from people who had histories of collaboration with Spanish authorities and institutions. Some of these people, referenced the fact that that they had fought with Spaniards throughout Asia. Maybe there were people who fought against the Chinese in 1603, or again during another Chinese uprising in 1639. Perhaps there were people who joined Spanish wars of invasion and conquest in what were called the Spice Islands, which are now in Indonesia, or in what is now Indonesia. And so these were people who could reference records of service, or alternatively could reference their Hispanicization. Perhaps they had entered into a Catholic union, and they were arguing that they needed these exemptions in order to be able to provide for their family, for example. And so there are some ways in which already within central Mexico, you have people negotiating the limitations of their sort of new subjecthood within the empire. And that's a question that I had when I started looking at other places within the Spanish Empire as well. As you mentioned, there are Asians who travel beyond Mexico. They end up on expeditions as far north as what's now the state of Oregon in the U.S. They participate in expeditions along the Californian coast as well. But we have examples of people who end up in the colonial capital of Santiago in Guatemala. And you have people who continue traveling further south and end up in Lima in Peru. As you mentioned, we have people who cross the Atlantic as well. They travel across Mexico, cross the Atlantic, end up in Spain. I mean, these are truly global trajectories and global lives of people who are traversing the full extent of the European imperial world at that time. And so when they do travel, they do continue to negotiate this categorization. And you have this kind of push and pull for people, for example, who end up in Lima, who get recorded in this tribute register. Many of them become categorized again as Indio or as indigenous. And you have in other records, though, in Lima, people who end up categorized as Chino. And so you have this negotiation, which has, legal implications as to, commercial activities, for example, what kind of subjecthood can somebody have within the Spanish Empire. The same is true when people cross the Atlantic and end up in Spain as well. They continue negotiating these categories.
So let's talk about maybe one person in particular, Catarina de San Juan, who I guess becomes a prominent religious figure in Mexico, I think. But I guess who was she, and how did she come to be in Mexico?
Yeah, I oftentimes describe Catarina de San Juan as one of the most remarkable people in early modern history that many people have never heard of. But if you have heard of a single person from this early mobility of Asians to the Americas, it probably is Catarina de San Juan, who is oftentimes known by another name, which is the China Poblana. Or the Asian woman of Puebla, Puebla being a city in Mexico. Catarina de San Juan is extremely important, in part because of the extraordinary life that she lives, and also because of sort of how she's remembered or misremembered today. So Catarina de San Juan was born around the beginning of the 17th century, as Mira, in somewhere in South Asia. We don't know exactly where. She was captured by the Portuguese in a slave trading raid. As a young girl, she was on a beach, and like many children who end up enslaved either by the Portuguese or the Spaniards in Asia, was simply sort of snatched away and was never heard of again by her family or by her community. And so she ends up on this Portuguese slave trading vessel that travels throughout the Indian Ocean world. She gets baptized and she is eventually traded to Spaniards in Manila. And like, many people of her time, she's traded across the Pacific, and ends up in the city of Puebla, as a kind of enslaved domestic servant of a well-to-do Spanish family. And it's there that she begins to gain a reputation as a devout Catholic, which you know, raises some attention among local Spaniards in Puebla, who start to think of her as, you know, this symbol of the success of the global Catholic enterprise, right? She gets upheld as this kind of model Catholic subject. In Puebla, she becomes a free person when her enslaver died. And you know, she part of her fame comes from the fact that that she remains a virgin throughout her life as well, which is you know, a highly prized a quality for a Catholic, a devout Catholic woman in Spanish eyes. And so she really becomes a kind of local superstar, or emblematic of a kind of local pride that Spaniards from Puebla have. And part of what has attracted the attention of historians and of contemporary Mexicans as well is the fact that the longest text to be published in colonial Mexico was about her life, which is just a remarkable thing. It's this enormous 3-volume hagiography, or sort of religious biography of her life, which, as you can imagine, includes a lot of sort of inflated detail about her life. This idea that, oh, maybe she was, you know, a princess in South Asia, and that sort of explains why she's become so renowned in Puebla. There are a lot of sort of inventions that go along with her rise to recognition. But one of the things that really caught my attention about her story was, you know, she exists in this in-between space. There's this kind of knowability about, you know, her devotion to Catholicism, but at the same time, she remains, for those who write about her, this kind of perpetual foreign subject, right? There's this idea that she can never truly be known by the people around her, or that she conceals from them her nature. She's mysterious, and you have this showing up again and again in the writing about her in the immediate aftermath of her death, and it's in that in-between state of recognition and foreignness of her enslavement earlier in her life and her later freedom, and the conflation between the two on the part of those who wrote about her, that to me is so emblematic of this kind of fluid subjecthood that the people who are called Chinos in Mexico have. You know, they occupy such a wide range of social possibilities. As I had mentioned, many of them end up in the Americas as enslaved people, like Catarina de San Juan. Other people themselves become enslavers. You know, you have this range. Some are described as being rather light-skinned, or even white in some cases. You have others that are described as black, and every possible gradation in between. And it's that capaciousness, that expansive nature of the category of who Chinos were, and the range of experiences and the many and varied lives that they have, that I think makes them such an instructive case for examining the process of racialization of people who are marginalized colonial subjects within the Spanish Empire.
So one interesting thing you talk about in your book, something I'm interested in, was the, let's call it the strategic use of blasphemy as a way to improve one's working and living conditions. And I guess to explain, it seems like they people would use blasphemy, and there would be an investigation by the authorities, and the authorities would say, yes, there was blasphemy, and the person seems to sincerely regret it, and they wouldn't have turned to blasphemy if they were treated better by their owner, you know. So, owner, please treat your slaves better. Which I find just a very, very fascinating strategy, I guess, a way to use, I guess, the culture of the time to kind of improve your conditions for those with not a lot of power. But I wonder if you might talk more about that and kind of what that tells us about Asians in the Spanish Empire.
Yeah, that's a great question. This is part of my chapter on enslavement in colonial Mexico in particular, and how enslaved Asians negotiated the conditions of their enslavement, right? And it's a seemingly paradoxical thing, right? That you would, in a situation in which, say, an enslaved Asian person is being punished. Oftentimes, these occurred on plantations. These punishments occur on plantations, for example, or in wealthy households, or in bake shops known as panaderias, which were also a kind of confined or space of imprisonment, even. And then, of course, there are the textile mills, which are called obrajes. And these were, the most brutal spaces of enslavement within colonial Mexico. And so here I'm building on the scholarship of people like Javier Villaflores, who has written extensively about the use of blasphemy on the part of enslaved Afro-Mexicans in these spaces. And it seems paradoxical that in a situation of punishment, that one would commit blasphemy and effectively get themselves in more trouble in order to address the cause of one's punishment to begin with. And so let me break that down. So basically, blasphemy oftentimes would trigger an inquisitorial denunciation or inquisitorial trial. The Inquisition, of course, was an institution that was active in Spain from the late 15th century, was established in Mexico City in 1571, and basically it policed the bounds between what was considered acceptable or unacceptable religious practice. The nature of the Spanish Empire was, you know, despite what we might sort of think about words like empire, it was in fact the influence and sort of the power and the ability of Spaniards to impose religion and culture and language in the areas that they claimed was in fact contested at every level. And so one of the places where you see that the most is within enslaved communities, where you have these contestations of religion and you have other religions that are forming within these enslaved communities against the grain of Catholicism. And so blasphemy becomes one of those practices in which an inquisitorial trial could get triggered by somebody, an enslaved Asian subject who, you know, during punishment renounces their Catholic religion. This could be in the form of sort of renouncing God and Jesus and the Virgin Mary and the saints and all of that. And so in the best of all possible circumstances, the Inquisition would come in, sort of hear the testimonies of those who denounce the person who blasphemed, hear the testimony of the person who blasphemed. And the person who commits blasphemy oftentimes would make the argument that they had only blasphemed because the punishment that they had received was so extreme and so unjust that they could not but sort of cry out against God and Jesus and the saints in order to try to get their punishers, oftentimes their enslavers or an overseer or foreman, for example, to stop the punishment. Sometimes it worked. Sometimes an enslaved person actually succeeded in getting transferred to a different enslaver as a result of this inquisitorial proceeding. In the worst possible circumstance, it would generate only more punishment. It would only enrage the punisher. Once the Inquisition gets involved, sometimes they would require even more punishment for the person who blasphemed. So it's really a kind of desperate tactic to try to call attention to the unjust nature of punishment against enslaved people. And as I mentioned, this is sort of an active tactic on the part of Afro-Mexicans in central Mexico. And once Asians arrive, they begin to collaborate within these spaces of enslavement and begin also participating in these tactics and spiritual cultures that again negotiate the conditions of their bondage. So for me, these are the first Afro-Asian interactions within the hemisphere, and are an important precursor to similar kinds of interactions that from the 19th century and beyond.
So I want to end by kind of asking, what actually happens to this Asian community in the Spanish Empire? And I ask because, you know, we had another author on the show, I think, a month or so ago, Hugo Wong, author of America's Lost Chinese, who talked about his ancestors, his Chinese ancestors, settling along the U.S.-Mexico border in northern Mexico in the 19th century, I believe, 19th century to early 20th century. And it seems like they're kind of the only ones there. I mean, there is a growing Chinese community, but it kind of grows in that period of time. It's not like, oh, there's actually been an Asian community here for centuries. Obviously, it's a different part of Mexico. It's and who knows if what people at the time actually thought, but it certainly seems like there weren't very many Asians in Mexico at that part in time. So what actually happens to the Asian community in Mexico, in Peru, kind of elsewhere in the empire?
Yeah, that's a great question. And that's one that I begin to take up in the last chapter of my book, which looks at, you know, what happens during the 18th century, the early 19th century, in other words, the late colonial period. Because the numbers of Asians who arrive in the Americas through this Manila Galleon route diminishes over time. Part of the reason for that is, people who are designated as Chinos in Mexico, they're formally emancipated from enslavement in 1672. That doesn't mean that, you know, the slavery and slave trans-Pacific slave trade in Asian captives ends at that point, but the fact that they're not supposed to be enslaved results in a process of gradual emancipation that lasts over the course of the next three or four decades after that. So consequently, the numbers of Asians arriving in the Americas diminishes. However, my research shows that, you know, Asians were present and visible sort of subsets of the colonial population in Mexico through the end of the colonial period, right up until independence. And I think there's plenty of room for future scholarship to look at that early national period and to evaluate the extent to which Asians continue to be visible in the population after independence. You're absolutely right. There's another wave of migration that has been studied in some more detail that begins during the 19th century in the Americas through the process of conscripted labor or indenture that is particularly intense in the Caribbean. 120,000 Chinese end up in Cuba. My own family history is connected to that movement to Cuba during the 19th century of Chinese. Approximately 100,000 Chinese end up in Peru. And then, of course, you have Chinese in Mexico, and in particular in the late 19th century under Porfirio Díaz's rule in Mexico. And so one of the things that I'm really interested in doing by bringing the study up to the early 19th century is to complicate these distinctions between, okay, you have an early modern wave of migration, and then you have a 19th century and 21st century waves of migration to the Americas. And to show that 19th century process of indenture and conscripted labor, which begins in Trinidad, really, was happening at the same time that Asians were still coming and going from Mexico through the Manila Galleons. And so you have this period in which there's an overlap between what we might call the quote-unquote modern periods of migration of Asians to the Americas and the early modern. And so I don't think it's easy to really have a clear divide between the two. I think that there is currently a need for more scholarship on that sort of mid 19th century period, particularly in Mexico, to show that kind of continuity in some more detail to the period that you referenced of Chinese Mexicans, and in particular in that border area.
Well, I think that's a great place to end our conversation with Diego Luis, author of The First Asians in the Americas, A Trans-Pacific History. Diego, I actually have two final questions for you, which are, where can people find your work? And what's next for you? What do you think the next project might be?
Yeah, so the book is available through Harvard University Press on their website. It's available on all the places you might look to buy a book: Amazon, Barnes and Noble, Powell's Books as well. As for what's next, there are a couple things that I'm working on right now. One is actually my own podcast about the book in collaboration with an award-winning podcast maker named Charles Fournier and my good friend Julian Saporiti of No No Boy. We're making a podcast about the story behind the book, sort of how one's own background and life experiences inform one's historical sensibilities and the kind of histories that we're drawn to research and write. So that's going on. And then I'm also working on a new book project, which focuses, again, on those two nodes of trans-Pacific trade, Manila and Acapulco, and shows that there were growing both free and enslaved Black populations in those places as well. That's something that that has rarely, if ever, been written about in the history of those places. So that's a story that I've been researching and really want to tell.
So you can follow me, Nicholas Gordon, on Twitter at NickRIGordon. That's NickRIGordon. You can go to AsianReviewBooks.com to find other reviews, essays, interviews, and excerpts. Follow on Twitter at BookReviewsAsia. That's reviews plural. And you can find many more author interviews in the New Books Network at NewBooksNetwork.com. We're on my favorite podcast apps, Apple Podcasts, Spotify. Rate us, recommend us, share us with your friends to support us interviewing those writing in, around, and about Asia. Next week, join us for an interview with Simon Partner, author of Kome's World, The Life and Work of a Samurai Woman Before and After the Meiji Restoration. But before then, Diego, thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Thank you for having me.